Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I acknowledge we're gathered on the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and I pay my respect to their elders, past and present. I'm Michael Fullilove. I'm Executive Director of the Lowy Institute, and I'm delighted to welcome you to tonight's event and to see a full house for this speech and session with the Honourable Charles Abel, Deputy Prime Minister and Treasurer of Papua New Guinea. Ladies and gentlemen, PNG is one of Australia's most important partners. In a speech delivered from this lectern in 2015, the former Secretary of DFAT, Peter Varghese, said that more than any other single relationship, the state of our relationship with PNG is seen as a barometer of Australian foreign policy success. And that's because the historical and geographical links between the two countries are so close. PNG is our nearest neighbour, with only a few kilometres separating it from Australia at one point. The country recently celebrated, of course, the 40th anniversary of its independence. Our two governments continue to cooperate across all sectors, including the economy, development, health, gender, security, immigration, and people-to-people issues. And this was reiterated in last year's foreign policy white paper, which said that supporting a stable and prosperous PNG is one of our most important foreign policy objectives. So it makes sense that PNG is core business for the Lowy Institute as well. Through our Pacific Islands program led by Jono Pryke, we raise awareness in Australia of the challenges facing PNG through policy relevant research and events. And we place a special priority on encouraging a new generation of leaders in PNG, which we do through hosting the Australia PNG Network and the annual AusPNG Emerging Leaders Dialogue, both of which are run by my colleague Anna Kirk. And we've just relaunched in Moresby a collection of seven papers on PNG, edited by Jonathan, that looks at the opportunities and challenges facing the country from a variety of perspectives. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been an important few years across the Torres Strait. The economy has had to deal with a downturn in commodity prices, but now an uptick. It's had a severe drought, and a number of other discontinuities. Last year, of course, PNG held a hotly contested election. It was terrific to see so many Papua New Guineans coming out to vote and demonstrating their commitment to democracy. And of course, in the big news, the PNG Hunters rugby league team won the 2017 Queensland Cup. This year will be even bigger. November will see a flock of world leaders descending on Port Moresby when PNG hosts the APEC Leaders Summit. And we know, Charles, that wherever Donald Trump goes, the eyes of the world go. So prepare yourself. So it's a great time, in other words, to hear from the DPM and Treasurer, Charles Abel. And I've known and admired Charles for a number of years. Charles graduated from UQ with a Bachelor in Economics. He was first elected to the PNG Parliament for the Alotau Open electorate in 2007. He served as Minister for Culture and Tourism between 2007 and 2010. Then he was Minister for Trade, Commerce and Industry. Then he was Minister for Planning from 2012 to 2017. And for the past year, a year ago I should say, he was appointed Treasurer and Deputy Prime Minister. As Minister for Planning, Charles played a lead role in producing the National Strategy for Responsible Sustainable Development, a key pillar of the National Development Plan. And now as Treasurer, he has the absolutely vital role of managing the PNG economy in the current conditions. He's someone that we see of great authority, both within PNG and abroad. He's a good friend of Australia's and a friend of mine in the Institutes, and we're honoured to have, and I'm delighted to welcome to the lectern, the Deputy Prime Minister and Treasurer, Charles Abel.
Thank you. Thank you indeed, Michael, for those kind words of introduction, and good evening, everyone. I'm so pleased to finally be here at the Lowy Institute after being invited several times by Jono or Jonathan. And my apologies, Jonathan, for taking so long to get here. But I know in the meantime, my Prime Minister has come and spoken twice. And I'm so glad he's given the due respect and recognition that the Institute deserves. So I have quite a long speech here that I will go through, and I don't particularly like reading speeches, but I don't like rambling on aimlessly either. And we've done enough rambling, I think, this afternoon in getting to know the staff here, the wonderful staff here at the Institute. But I will take the time to go through the prepared statement that I have before me. And I'd like to say at the outset to acknowledge our chairman, Sir Frank Lowy, and of course the board and the executive director, Michael Philly Love, and the experts and the operations staff here at the Lowy Institute, to Jonathan Pryke, of course, the director of the Pacific Islands program. Thank you once again so much for this invitation. Invited guests, friends of Papua New Guinea, and the media that are here, it's nice to see a full house. Good evening, and thank you for the opportunity, as I said, to address you here at this wonderful institution, the Lowy Institute. I did attend, of course, as I mentioned, when Prime Minister O'Neill gave an address on Papua New Guinea's Asian century some years ago. I've got here the 14th of May 2017, but of course that's incorrect. It was a couple of years before that. And of course, as mentioned, it was during one of my previous roles, which was the Minister for National Planning for Papua New Guinea. So I want to thank the founders and supporters of the Lowy Institute and the hardworking staff over the years since 2003 for providing this platform for leaders from the Pacific and for the very useful information that you publish from time to time. I note, as Michael has mentioned, the 7 snapshots of a nation that was launched by Jonathan, or relaunched by Jonathan, at the University of Papua New Guinea Update 2018 series last week. And of course, the contributions to those 7 snapshots by Val Karmer, Paul Barker, Sinclair Dinan, David Osborne, who is also with us here this evening, Christopher Hoy, and Robert Harden. And we thank them for that work, which I've had an opportunity to read, actually. And Jonathan has organized through the Institute some hard copies of that, which I think will be useful, and I look forward to getting a copy of that as well. I did give the opening address at that University of Papua New Guinea update, and much of what I say here will be of a similar nature. That's why I said to Luke Parmagee and some of the others that were also at the University of Papua New Guinea will hear many of those similar tones through that, as I comment on the economy, a little bit on APEC, of course, the Australian relationship, my views for the future of Papua New Guinea and the Papua New Guinea-Australia relationship, and some of the selected highlights, with trying not to take too much of your precious time. But as always, before I do, I want to take the time and the opportunity to express the gratitude of the government and the people of Papua New Guinea for the support Australia gives to us through thick and thin in the past, today, and into the future. Australia has been a genuine friend to Papua New Guinea, and it goes without saying that a successful Papua New Guinea is very much in both of our interests. I stand here as the Deputy Prime Minister and Treasurer of a beautiful and blessed country, but a country also beset with a myriad of challenges of which you are all well familiar. The task of maintaining a functioning democracy, political stability, policy quality and consistency, and delivering effective, tangible outcomes in a country 43 years out from independence, with 800 scattered tribes in a difficult terrain, with volcanoes and earthquakes that we've seen again of late, transitioning from tribal society to the internet age, has been difficult to say the least. And we don't want to keep making excuses, but it is a significant contextual aspect which makes some of the achievements to date more remarkable than we would otherwise give credit for. A general highlight in this context is the sustenance of democracy in the first place, or indeed Papua New Guinea's version of democracy. One of the points I made last week, which is noteworthy, is the sustained period of political stability since 2002 to today, prior to which there was at least one or more changes of government per electoral term. The National Alliance-led government under Sir Michael Somare completed almost 2 full terms. This was due in part, of course, to the Morauta government instituted legal changes that limited movements of members of parliament between parties. These provisions were since deemed unconstitutional. The O'Neill-led governments of 2011-12 and 2012-2017 have sustained under the relatively original provisions of the Constitution and was the first government to survive a full term of Parliament with the full freedom of movement of members of Parliament. Democracy is a prerequisite, and some semblance of political stability is a prerequisite also for holistic development. The experience since independence in the constant changes through motions of no confidence made it extremely difficult for any sort of constructive governance. It would be naive, though, to conclude that the PNG party system has reached political maturity, although it certainly is improving. Much of the credit for this stability goes to the political leadership of Prime Minister Honourable Peter O'Neill. Political stability is important, but not at the cost of political entrenchment. The mechanism of motions of no confidence are fine, but the various hurdles, such as the number of members required to sponsor a motion, must not be so low as to make it potentially frivolous. A weak party system that we still have, in conjunction with an easily activated no confidence process and short grace periods, can lead to election mandates being usurped and political management being the order of the day rather than constructive governance. So, political stability under our Prime Minister has enabled us to test our policies in the last 6 years. We are also able to compare these with the NA-led government, which was in power for 9 continuous years, or indeed compare our policies with any other government. But at the very least, we have had a primary basis for governance, unlike in the past, and so we must take best advantage of this to progress reforms and development. The National Alliance government, particularly in its second term, enjoyed huge revenue flows from a commodity boom and built up large trust account balances that unfortunately, and despite some good intentions, were rapidly spent without too much to show for. When I came in as planning minister in 2012, the sweep task force was investigating much of the abuse that had happened at the Department of Planning, and we had to review this method of pooling and distributing funds from various programs, such as the National Agriculture Development Program, the RESI program, and the Social Development Program, to name a few. Despite that wastage, the NA government got the debt down and delivered the Papua New Guinea LNG project. The current low price environment is revealing some flaws in the project agreement, and of course, we did not provide for domestic market obligation or local content obligations. Nevertheless, it was a massive achievement which will bear more fruit one day. Our 25-point plan under the new government responds to these project agreement flaws and the general quandary and why, despite a large current account surplus, we face revenue and foreign exchange shortages today. The other obvious question posed is why we continue to support arrangements that send our oil and gas offshore only to import refined petroleum products back in and look for foreign exchange to pay for it. Imported crude oil and diesel incur the highest foreign exchange bills for a single imported product in Papua New Guinea, followed next by rice. I will just jump sideways now and veer off before coming back to the PNC coalition experience and the economy. I want to make some comments about education in particular. And the fastest way to progress a nation and to enable its people, and the primary enabler is the quality education. This is only made more evident in the information and technology revolution we are in today. I've had the opportunity to travel to the United States, Asia, and Israel recently. One thing which continues to strike me as I compare countries is that we have one of the best education systems in the world on our doorstep right here in Australia. Of course, Papua New Guinea needs to build its own international standard education system, but as an accelerator to that, I really believe we need to integrate our education system more with the Australian system to take better advantage of it. The development assistance from Australia to Papua New Guinea should have education as its primary focus, and this should comprise in the shorter term of providing 500 to 1,000 places per year for the higher achievers from grade 9 into Australian boarding schools. There should be a large program placing Australian lecturers in our universities and teachers in our schools and vice versa. I have recently written to the High Commissioner, the Australian High Commissioner of Papua New Guinea, Bruce Davis, on this, and I will take it up with my counterpart, your Treasurer, Scott Morrison, and with your Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop, when we meet later on this week, in fact, tomorrow. The people-to-people engagement between our countries that we always talk about needs more realisation. Papua New Guineans should have visa on arrival status for tourism short-stay purposes and family visits in the same manner that we offer to Australians coming to Papua New Guinea. There should be more Australians in Papua New Guinea and more Papua New Guineans in Australia. We need to accelerate the education of our young people, the quality of English spoken and written expression, the adoption of the latest technology and systems by greater interaction with the Australian people and education system. This is the help we need whilst we also build the Papua New Guinean system. 400 or 500 Papua New Guineans returning a year from the Australian high school or university system per year is the fastest way I can think of to create the critical mass of a middle class, which then feeds into leadership, bureaucracy, and business innovation. Another significant and related accelerator in terms of global integration and access to knowledge and education is a modern ICT infrastructure network. The new 20 terabyte cable from Sydney to Port Moresby and the domestic submarine cable and terrestrial fiber optic network are critical. Access to cheap, speedy internet means access to knowledge and education. It's a no-brainer. Cheap and accessible electricity and internet at village level is transformative. It is part of the 25-point plan, and the procurement of the international cable is underway, again with the help of our Australian friends. The phase one of the national broadband network is almost complete, with phase two under consideration, and we have signed up for the construction of the domestic submarine cable, which will also provide an international gateway to Asia through Jayapura, Indonesia. Events such as the 2018 APEC meeting are also about global integration, participation, and knowledge sharing. We need modern capital and technology to develop. It is a bold undertaking by our small country, APEC that is, to introduce ourselves to the world, and we are committed. We just need to take full advantage of it. The obvious point I'm making here is the importance of education and an educated population. Again, it's an obvious point. It is the key because we have all the other elements necessary in the development equation. The standard of our human capital is hindering the speed of the transformation to a modern economy and delivering the minimum socio-economic standards. I say these things also in terms of the relationship between our two countries and the need to respond to the dynamic of the rise of the Asia-Pacific and China as a global power. We need to be fully aware of this in terms of the opportunities and challenges it represents. The traditional relationships, development assistance, business and trade are all shifting. Australia and the United States need to step up and respond. The geographical proximity and shared bonds of history between us means we can respond from a people-to-people and relationship basis. We want and need trade and investment. We appreciate concessional financing, but we also hold dear democracy and its principles and institutions. We like free press, freedom of speech, and human rights. Many of these foundations still remain fragile, and we need our traditional partners to remain fully engaged in the region with us. When the O'Neill-Nama and then the O'Neill-Dion government took power, we began a deliberate program to create a larger resource envelope and invest heavily into infrastructure, education, health, and law and order. This commenced with the famous tuition fee-free policy in 2011. The government continued and pursued a policy of deliberate deficit budgets to continue fiscal stimulus after the Papua New Guinea LNG construction phase and to bridge the gap until production began. There was much excitement and anticipation leading into first gas because it was touted that our revenues would double. It's an old story now, of course, that the oil prices collapsed almost immediately after production commenced in 2014. We then faced the El Nino drought and then the devastating earthquake and then difficult national elections. The good news is that there has been significant and visible improvements in our productive capacity through infrastructure in terms of roads, the major sea and airports, hospitals and schools. This stimulates the economy and makes services more accessible. Our economy is slowly becoming more diversified, and revenue reliance on the mineral and petroleum sector has greatly reduced. The bad news is that against the growth in GDP, particularly related to the PNG LNG project, against which we spent many hundreds of millions for the equity investment and landowner commitments, we have not had the corresponding revenue growth, while the interest burden and cost of the public service has grown. So with these experiences behind us, the O'Neill-Able government, following the 2017 elections, instituted the 100-day 25-point plan, commencing with the 2017 supplementary budget, and now the 2018 budget is responding with measures to increase revenue to 14.6% of GDP and beyond, restricting costs to 16% of GDP, maintaining a debt-to-GDP ratio below 35% and bringing budgets back to balance over time, bringing on the Papua New Guinea LNG expansion project, the Papua LNG and the Wafi-Golpu projects under an improved fiscal template, progressing internal generation of cheaper, cleaner and more reliable power and reducing reliance on imported diesel. And there's some specifics obviously behind these particulars I mentioned. But we can talk about some of those details perhaps later. Progressing the local production of rice, stock feed, dairy, vegetables, eggs and meat, particularly to reduce imports and, of course, foreign exchange demand. Addressing the foreign exchange shortage itself and interest costs through central bank intervention, new project acceleration and debt restructuring to bring in the balance of the Credit Suisse loan, the World Bank budget support and the ADB health loan and budget support, which, of course, I signed off on last week. And one of the points I highlighted was the significance of the fact that Papua New Guinea is receiving budget support through the budget support modality for the first time in probably 30 years or more in relation to grant or concessional funding support. And so it signifies great confidence from the Asian Development Bank in terms of what is happening in the Papua New Guinea economy. That was signed off last week. And, of course, we're working on completing the World Bank requirements for $150 million in budget support from them this year. And the other thing that I'll mention, of course, is our inaugural sovereign bond, which we'll be pursuing this year and launching into that marketing roadshow shortly, which are all part of the 2018 budget, but also go to the issue in terms of some immediate relief in foreign exchange and interest costs because of the debt restructuring. The other significant support from the Asian Development Bank is the $1 billion U.S. Multi-tranche financing facility for fixing the Highlands Highway once and for all. We're going a long way towards it anyway. I've mentioned the upgrading of the international submarine telecommunication cable and building the national broadband network that is critical. Completion of the Lae and Port Moresby seaports and the activation and engagement of an international operator to come in and operate those new ports. This has taken place. Our ongoing commitments to supporting SMEs and, of course, meeting our commitments to free education, health, and the commitments we have made to the lower level governments, in particular the provincial governments and, of course, our districts. It should not also be forgotten how the 2017 supplementary budget, after the election, we took the difficult decision to cut provincial and district grant funding under the DSIP and PSIP programs, for which we cut by 80%. The 2017 final budget outcome has reported a 31.9% debt to GDP ratio and a 2.4% fiscal deficit based on our response to maintain the parameters of the 2017 budget and to maintain fiscal discipline. Of course, we need to continue to give the due attention to institutional governance, especially around accountability and procurement and also corruption. The Prime Minister will be making some announcements shortly on the activation of the much talked about ICAC. And the 25-point plan has elements also that address procurement and reporting. The sweep of government accounts through the Public Money Management Regularization Act, which I introduced in the 2018 budget, has not only raised significant revenues that we can use for frontline services, but also reduced our domestic financing costs. So we were previously borrowing this very same money back through treasury bills from the banks who held these surplus funds. So borrowing our own money back from the banks anyway. Through this act, we now have more visibility and are able to utilize excess funds sitting in the banking system that belong to the government. The government is also committed to getting a fairer share of returns on our natural resources, whilst appreciating the significance of these resources, such as our forest, tuna stocks and biodiversity, in a global sense, as explained in the National Strategy for Responsible Sustainable Development, or STARS that we developed when I was the planning minister. The Alotau Accord, two, highlights the high population growth rate also as a development priority, and new programs in health with the World Bank and the ADB emphasize access to family planning in conjunction with our good friends in the UNDP and other NGO partners. With the impact coming through of our 25-point plan interventions as captured in the 2017 supplementary and 2018 budgets and the oil price sustaining above $70 per barrel, the indicators are looking promising. If it were not for the massive earthquake affecting gas, oil and gold production, at current prices, we were certainly looking at outdoing the 2018 budget revenue projections. We will publish a mid-year financial outlook report shortly to see exactly how we are tracking. So we acknowledge the tough times that we've had and the difficulties that still continue, and that is exactly why our government has responded as it did straight after the elections. I believe that the APEC event this year will cap off a year of recovery for our country in a spectacular fashion. And APEC should be seen as a culmination of sorts of an effort to bring focused investment, tourism and engagement for Papua New Guinea and the Pacific through events such as the APC parliamentary meetings, the Pacific Games and the Under 20 Women's World Cup. Apart from the general engagements, specific proposals are being prepared for prospective investments, climate or green funds, grant and concessional funding as we engage in APEC. Ladies and gentlemen, I will conclude my remarks here, but as I wrote in Stars and speaking to what we continue to see as a vision for Papua New Guinea, Papua New Guinea needs to deliberately transition to a new socio-economic paradigm by slowing its population growth rate, accelerating the education of its people to international standard, and based on the 15% of the world's tuna that we have, the third largest rainforest, 8% of the world's biodiversity, fertile soil and abundant water, and 800 cultures, we need to build an economy that feeds and energizes itself and exports surplus food, power, and climate stability to the rest of the world. Mineral and petroleum resources to be converted or partially converted into a sovereign wealth fund from which only rents can be extracted and not the capital. And this very much should be an aspiration at the very least. So let us all continue to work together for a prosperous and stable region, for a prosperous and stable Papua New Guinea. Australia and Papua New Guinea have a very, very special bond. And regardless of what happens, that will not change. Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Charles, for giving a really wide-ranging and substantive speech with lots of information. And I'm sure there's lots of elements that the audience would like to ask you about. We've got about 25 or 30 minutes of questions. The DPM is willing to take your questions. So I'm going to ask a couple of questions to begin with, but please, I hope to look up and see a sort of a rainforest of trees, if I can start where you finished, a rainforest of arms, I should say, of people who'd like to ask you questions. Let me say, I think we all acknowledge some of the challenges that you mentioned that PNG has. I think it was Charles de Gaulle who said something like, how can you expect a country like France to govern itself when it has 246 kinds of cheese? And all the more so when you think of, as you say, the different cultural groups in PNG, the geography of the place, but also the enormous riches of the country and in particular the quality and the caliber of the people. Let me ask you a couple of things. First of all, let me ask you about APEC. You mentioned that hosting APEC was about presenting PNG's face to the world. Can you be a bit more precise about what are the advantages that you hope will flow to PNG from hosting APEC, which after all is an enormous logistical and financial task for a country of PNG's size? And can you give us any indications on what you'll get the leaders to wear in the family photo where they wear their national dress?
One of the cultures that we have, as you might know, is in Telefomin, where you wear the penis gourds. You know, you have that in front. And so basically nothing else but a penis gourd. So we'll get Donald Trump up there for a photo opportunity. No, look.
I didn't know that question would go in that direction, but that's fine. That's fine. You've got the microphone, DPM, so.
Yeah, no, look, we took on APEC, knowing it would be a massive challenge for such a small country, but knowing as well that we were a member of APEC, and as such, we wanted to fulfil some of our obligations in that sense. And I think there's only a couple of us left in APEC. I think there's two of us that haven't actually hosted APEC. So knowing it was a challenge for us, nevertheless, we undertook it partially for that reason, to fulfil our obligations in that sense. But obviously, you know, bringing these leaders, including Donald Trump and Xi Jinping and everyone else to Papua New Guinea will put the spotlight on our country. And we all know what wonderful opportunities Papua New Guinea presents and what wonderful people we have and wonderful resources. And I think oftentimes Papua New Guinea has been painted in a different sort of light. And much of what is perceived out there about Papua New Guinea can be largely negative from what is reported. So at the very least, we wanted to put the spotlight and demonstrate, bring the focus and show the world what wonderful opportunities Papua New Guinea presents. But there are a range of other regional issues and things that we've been trying to progress as well in terms of cross-border trade facilitation and financial integration and so on that haven't really progressed in the way we would like. And so I think this also gives us an opportunity to elevate some of those issues, including our regional issues in that sense, in terms of trade and financial facilitation, issues around climate change, where we continue to say that Papua New Guinea is on the front line, countries like Papua New Guinea in terms of climate change. We're the first country to have climate refugees, of course. And yet we find it very difficult to access assistance in relation to that, knowing full well that there is so much resources out there available, knowing how imperative the climate change issue is, and yet those of us who are on the front line of it find it extremely difficult to get any sort of help to address it and to mitigate it. Whilst at the same time saying that we've got the resources I mentioned, we can actually contribute something back towards climate stability if we can develop mechanisms that not only help us in the immediate term, but help us in the longer term to protect resources like our rainforest, which ultimately will be the carbon sink, will be the resources we need to keep intact to give that climate stability, while at the same time providing a mechanism to give us some of the revenue and development assistance we need. So there's a whole range of issues that we want to highlight from our perspective, and I think bringing these leaders to Papua New Guinea will help us do that, not just Papua New Guinea, but regionally. But then there's also the tourism aspect of it and the visitation, the stimulation of business in the immediate sense, the engagement with businesses as well. And as I said, we're developing some proposals, specific proposals we can put to businesses to perhaps interest them to come and make investments, so that it's not just too broad a discussion, but we actually have some particulars that we can present in terms of paperwork and numbers, so that the engagement with the business community, which is what APEC is all about really, at the end of the day, it's about trade and investment, business. We can develop some specific investment activity after APEC. Infrastructure is also being created. It's an opportunity for us to generate some infrastructure with some of our partners. And if you come to Port Moresby, you'll see how dramatically it is changing because we have been undertaking some of these international activities and events. It's not to say that Port Moresby is the only place in Papua New Guinea. It's a big and diverse country, of course, but Port Moresby is the entry point to Papua New Guinea. It is the face of Papua New Guinea in the first instance. So we'll be proud that our city is transforming. And APEC House, the whole development of Ella Beach, the new roads that have gone in, the big convention centre, these things will all be able to be utilised going into the future to further investment conferences, tourism, the upgrading of our museum, and so on and so forth. So there's many aspects to it. And of course, it'll be good to see them dressed up in those penis squads. Mm.
None of us want to visualise that, Charles. You mentioned the convention centre and the roads, and I understand that some of those at least have been financed by China. One of the foreign leaders that you mentioned has confirmed he will attend is Xi Jinping. Can you talk to us a bit about, here in Australia it's a big debate at the moment, the growing presence of China in the Pacific, the rumours of a potential base in Vanuatu, the increases in aid into lots of different Pacific countries. Tell us how China is increasing its presence in PNG. How do you see it and feel it as a leading figure in PNG national life?
Yeah, look, I think we can all appreciate what is happening in a global and a regional sense in terms of the elevation, as I said in my speech, of the Asia-Pacific. And of course, particularly in terms of the elevation and the rise of China. And one thing is for certain, China is on the rise, and it is something that we all have to deal with one way or the other. And we've got to realize and understand and examine all aspects of it, the threats and the opportunities. But you've got to engage with China. So China is coming, China is rising, and China is presenting many opportunities for countries like Papua New Guinea. They're providing options for us in terms of funding and capital and expertise. They are, I suppose, competing in the same space that traditionally, countries like Australia and the United States were in. And in many ways, it presents opportunities for Papua New Guinea. But it also presents a lot of challenges. And that's what I've been saying to the Australian government, that some of the things that the Chinese interaction brings are not necessarily conducive to good governance, particularly if some of our country's institutional frameworks are weak. And so we very much need our traditional partners to continue that engagement in the region and in Papua New Guinea to make sure there's some balance brought there and support us in this development process that whilst we appreciate the interaction with China, there remains some concerns in terms of the way they do conduct business. I don't think it's anything intentional. It's just that they're such a large animal. And in some of these engagements with smaller countries, there can be a tendency to overwhelm us. There can be a tendency to inadvertently undermine some of our systems. So, one, we've got to deal with China. China is, there is a definite shift and movement going on within our region. The situation in Papua New Guinea is in flux. And that's why I make some of the comments in my speech in terms of the relationship with Australia and Australia stepping up in terms of some of the way it's been conducting business with Papua New Guinea and Australia taking advantage of some of its competitive strengths in terms of the people-to-people relationship and the history. I see Charlie Lynn standing at the back there. Things like the Kokoda Track, you can't replace those things overnight. There's a real fundamental basis of a relationship with Australia that is special. And I think we just need to continue to review that relationship and how we conduct ourselves so that Australia remains relevant and an important and significant partner in Papua New Guinea. So we are dealing with this change in the landscape. And I know Australia is dealing with it as well and many of the other countries in the Pacific and indeed the world. But for now, it's presenting us with opportunities, I would say, and Papua New Guinea is going to grasp those opportunities. China is an important partner. At the same time, we're going to be conscious the fact that we do cherish certain elements, as I mentioned in my speech, and we don't want to undermine the very important work in building the institutional capacity that we have in the headlong rush for development and easy capital. There's very real risks that are emerging in that process.
All right. Let me please raise your hand if you'd like to ask a question. And saw that gentleman first, so we'll give the microphone to him.
Thank you. My name is Jim Deminks, and I want to ask about APEC and some of the follow-on from that, and particularly in relation to PNG's foreign policy. I was looking at your linkages, your relationships around the region, all internationally, and it seemed to me you have some 17 or 18 diplomatic or foreign or official relationships, but there didn't seem to be any new relationships for 40 years since 75, 76. Maybe my information was outdated, but there were a few relatively close neighbours that seemed to be missing from the list, including, for instance, Singapore, and of course Timor-Leste is even closer still. Would you see that changing as time goes by, please, Deputy Prime Minister?
Thank you, Jim. Obviously, we want to broaden our relationship and be engaged with as many people as possible, particularly in the region. And that is happening slowly over time. Today, as we speak, we have the existing offices and relationships that are there. And to be quite frank, sometimes it's not easy even maintaining existing offices and the costs and so on that are involved with that. So there is a definite intention there. There is a ramping up of a relationship with partners in the Asia and Pacific region that is happening. But perhaps, like many of our aspirations, we're perhaps not moving on some of them as fast as we would like, including we had intentions of opening offices in Singapore and other locations throughout the Asia Pacific and indeed the world. Some of these plans have had to be slowed down somewhat as we consolidate and make sure that and when we do open offices that are sustainable, we're able to effectively operate them. So I think the concentration at the moment is making sure the existing offices are fully functional and, you know, but the intention, of course, is to continue to expand our diplomatic reach. And one of the ways to do it is to bring people to our shores, I suppose, through activities such as APEC as well. And that's part of that engagement as well in the region. So the aspiration is there, but it's the timing of these things, eh? It all comes back to the budget and the treasurer.
Yeah, you can't really blame the bean counters when you're the treasurer, DPM.
Thank you, Deputy Prime Minister. Thank you for the talk. Wonderful. As a former member of the New South Wales Parliament, could I counsel you when considering ACCC not to adopt the New South Wales model? It would make you look like paradigm's virtue already. It's broken. So I'd counsel you against that. But on another side, I think, you know, Papua New Guinea is the custodian of the wartime history of the Pacific, with enormous markets in Japan, the United States, and Australia. And I believe it's the last adventure in the world for real adventure tourism and cultural tourism. And I think that's a gold mine that will just keep on giving when we get it right. So you have the, without doubt, the greatest country in the world for adventure tourism. You've got your people are your greatest asset. And I think there's enormous potential. I would hope that this issue will be examined in APEC. And will assist you in realising your potential in this area. And I know as a former Minister for Tourism, you're fairly close to it. So my question is, will you be addressing the wartime tourism and adventure tourism as part of your APEC considerations this year?
Thank you, Charlie. And I want to say thank you so much for all the wonderful work you've done for tourism in Papua New Guinea, particularly on the Kokoda track, which you've walked 1,000 times. I've only walked it once. I don't know how you're still going. But we really appreciate your interest in tourism. I attended the closing dinner for the Tourism Ministers meeting, APEC meeting, a couple of weeks ago. And tourism is certainly an aspect of the APEC engagement, and tourism is certainly one of the priorities in our development program. It is seen as one of the, one of our points of difference, particularly around some of the things you mentioned, including the war history. And we've got several initiatives underway, particularly in the engagement with Japan, and of course with Australia, where most of our tourists come from, and a lot of the interest is around the war history. But of course, there's so many other aspects to this beautiful and diverse country that we want to market, and APEC will provide that opportunity, but also help us to articulate some of the broader issues we have with tourism in terms of the cost, in terms of the perception issues that Papua New Guinea has that really, really impede people getting to our country or people wanting to come to Papua New Guinea so they can access and see these. So one of the things we'll be doing, of course, is taking the opportunity to take some of the leaders outside of Port Moresby into Goroka and into Kabiang, into Milne Bay, to see some of these sites and see for themselves, experience the place, and they can of course communicate back when they go. So tourism is on the agenda, and tourism with agriculture is something that our government in particular is trying to invest more into, and plus of course the engagement of our people through the SME and so on, so that our people are empowered. So it's an important aspect of APEC. But along with many other issues, it will certainly be on the agenda. So thanks. Thanks, Sean.
I'm going to call on John O'Prike, and then the next person I saw was the lady on the edge.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks, Deputy Prime Minister. You entered into this new role in the middle of 2017 with a very ambitious agenda that highlighted in your 25-point plan. How has progress been on the 25-point plan, and what have been the major challenges, and how do you hope to keep momentum going at that pace as this government matures?
Yeah, you know, Jonathan, when you make commitments and undertake impressive lists and tasks, you're setting yourself up somewhat, you know, because you're committing to something. And politicians or people in general don't like committing to specifics, you know. But I thought it was necessary. I'm a person that likes to get things done. You know, God has given me this opportunity, I suppose, through our Prime Minister, to be Deputy Prime Minister and Treasurer, which I don't know if it's ever happened before in the history of Papua New Guinea in terms of that combination. And, of course, trying to respond meaningfully and proactively to the issues at hand, to use that springboard as an opportunity to bring some of these reforms that Papua New Guinea has been crying for a long time. And I often say to the media, when talking about the 25-point plan, I say to them, you go ahead and read it first. Read the 25-point plan, and then you can tell me yourself how it's progressing. But the first two things on the list was the 2017 supplementary budget and the 2018 budget. And precisely everything that we've committed to in the 25-point plan is captured, or largely captured, within there. And the simple thing I talked about today, just the act of cutting through the 2017 supplementary budget, bringing it back to its original parameters of the 2017 budget proper, was difficult. We had to seek the understanding of all the politicians to cut that funding that was going directly to the districts that they utilise for all the small projects that they do down there. Commencing with that, and then, of course, restoring the parameters, as I already described, in terms of the deficit and the debt to GDP. And then through the 2018 budget, a whole list of reforms that I could spend a long time here explaining those to you. But otherwise, the general list that I read out in relation to the energy sector, the telecommunications sector, the cost restraint in the public service, the foreign exchange issues, executing a debt restructuring plan, all these elements, they're being progressed. And in fact, we published a recent the other day, and I was quite surprised how much of these things we are progressing. And I think the thing is just maintaining that commitment to it and seeing it through, reporting against it, and getting it done. And I think I was explaining with the staff, I'm very pleased, or with Michael, commitment of our Prime Minister and Cabinet so far to that process. And so each and everything that I talk about executing, signing off on the ADB loan last week, progressing a development policy, operation, macro policy, the Prime Minister will sign to give to the World Bank to do that, the preparations and all the engagement for the sovereign bond that will come out, the big investment that's gone into the IRC for capacity building, things like the getting the first dairy farm going, getting the, it's now going to go up to 12,000 litres of milk per day, getting the POM gas 58 megawatt electricity plant, utilising gas from our own soil for the first time to generate power, cheap, clean power into Papua New Guinea for the first time. Little things like that are significant because we continue otherwise to export our oil, export our gas, and then we turn around and look at foreign exchange to re-import it back in again. So some of those fundamentals in terms of food production, energy production, getting the telecommunications right, they're all in the 25-point plan. And I think, you know, if you have a look at each and every one of those points, we are making progress. There's one or two that's still, of course, I'd like some more done about, and one of them is the public service cost control, particularly payroll management and those reforms under AUSPIAC, the organisation that the committee that is established to manage some of these things. There still needs to be work done in certain areas, but the broader imperatives and the broader initiatives are progressing, and in fact, many are ticked off. So we'll report against that, and we'll also report against, through the mid-year financial outlook, the progress of the 2018 budget. And I'll take the opportunity at that time to explain in detail each and every one of the points and how they're going. But I'm very confident. Like I said at the outset, when you do commit to something, you are taking a risk, and I'm very conscious of that. As time ticks by and people are waiting in the wings to criticise and complain, but I say, and I go back to that point, have a look at the 25-point, actually read it and the details behind it so that you'll actually see that many of the things that I'm talking about today and what are being achieved are part of that plan and are being systematically achieved, but it's incomplete. There's still quite a way to go, but it's looking very positive.
Hi there, my name's Alicia Dundas. I work for Uniting World, and I believe we have a long-standing relationship with you and your family, so it's a delight to hear you speak here in Australia. We partner with the churches in Papua New Guinea, particularly the United Church, and I know the churches have provided health and education services to the country for many years, and I know you're a big champion of the church-state partnership. I wonder if you could tell us what are some of the challenges and opportunities of that partnership moving forward?
Thank you. We just travelled down here from Townsville, and we had the opportunity to continue to support a wonderful, wonderful partner in YWAM, Youth with a Mission, and through their medical ship program, but also the extension work they do through the young people that go and stay in the villages and provide fellowship and also help in practical ways. And the YWAM support we gave to enable them to buy the bigger ship, MB YWAM, was assisted with 5.5 million kina from the Church Partnership Program. the revamp program we did after I came in as planning minister, and we did the reforms to the social development program. One of the programs I explained that had been established through the National Alliance government, but very, very loose pools of money, supposedly to help churches, but end up being slush funds and just arbitrarily sort of dispensed. And we tried to concentrate that program down after doing an audit of all those activities into a more focused program on education and health and developing strategic partnerships. And YWAM was an example. And of course, Mission Aviation Fellowship, the third level airline, is another example. But otherwise, generally speaking, we apportioned the annual money to the churches that were already engaged and delivering education health services. So if the Catholic Church is providing 50% of the education services in Papua New Guinea, they got 50% of the education allocation in the church partnership program. So that it was clear, defined, specific, and reinforcing government's policy to deliver health and education. It wasn't just a loose dispersion of funds based on all the broad activities of the churches. So that was the reforms we did. And of course, YWAM is heavily involved, the medical ships, in delivering medical services to remote communities that wouldn't otherwise see a doctor or a dentist or any sort of medical service. So we're grateful to our churches, and through this program, we don't provide enough money through the church partnership program, but on a recurrent basis, we provide 117 million kina a year to support churches' wages and other recurrent costs. And then this year, it's only 10 million through the church partnership program. It's not really enough, but it's certainly more strategic, and it's part of the review of the way that the development budget was structured under the previous government to add value. But the churches are an example of a strategic partnership assisting government to deliver its objectives, particularly in education and health, but also because of the moral foundation they provide through the schooling system, which we feel in Papua New Guinea is very, very important, that sort of Christian foundation, in terms of the moral foundation to build your life upon.
Hi, good evening. I'm April Palmerle from the American Chamber of Commerce. As Michael said, where President Trump goes, the eyes of the world follow. There's already quite a good buzz about PNG among the American business community. ExxonMobil featured the plant at PNG on the cover of their global annual report. I'm gathering a group of business leaders to come to PNG in August and look at the specific opportunities available for American, Australian, Canadian companies there. And I just wonder if you'd like to share a message that I can take to our delegation about what you'd like them to keep in mind as they come to PNG.
Look, I was talking about in my speech, America is right up there in terms of our traditional partners in the region, starting with the World War II, and of course progressing through to successful stories like what ExxonMobil has done in terms of that LNG project. And I think that is, apart from some of the issues we're having in terms of revenue and so on in the low commodity price regime, it really is a wonderful, wonderful story, and something I think Exxon and us can use as an entree to other American businesses to show what can be achieved in Papua New Guinea, even though it was so difficult putting the financing together and the challenges with the landowners. It was delivered on time, on budget, and it's producing above nameplate, the expectation. So it's a success story, and we have a great relationship with the American embassy there, and the wonderful series of ambassadors that have come through. And I can only say that Papua New Guinea is full of opportunities, not just in the mineral sector, but you name it, whether it's in tourism or green technology, forest management, tuna business and resource management in the marine area. A whole range of opportunities that Papua New Guinea can offer, and we want to continue to engage with the U.S. And as I said before, we would like to see the U.S. businesses and government step up its presence in the region. We don't particularly agree with some of the recent body language in terms of withdrawing, I suppose. We think that America should continue to stand up and shine the light for democracy and liberty and maintain that presence to keep the balance in the region. I think it's very important. So commercially, but also politically, we very much welcome America to the region, and of course, and to APEC.
Charles, I might take the last question, if I may. You made a point that it's important with the rise of China for PNG, in a way to not to neglect the relationship with Australia and to double down on it in ways. What would be your advice to Australian governments going the other way in terms of not neglecting our relationship with PNG? I mean, it's something we feel strongly at the Institute that PNG is a really important bilateral relationship, but also we sometimes feel that it's a little neglected in the media and in the national life of Australia, in that we have a long, deep historical connections to PNG, but with every year that goes on and takes us further away from independence, some of those relationships are a bit thinner. What do you think friends of PNG in Australia should do, and what do you think the Australian government could do to strengthen the bilateral relationship with PNG?
It's always going to be a quandary, you know, to an extent, because you've got a country that is aspiring to be independent and mature. At the same time, we have this relationship, traditional relationship with Australia, through which we often come to Australia in times of need for help. And so it's this funny tension there. But as I said in my speech, I think ultimately we should continue to foster this special relationship because of all the factors that we have described. And I think through various means, and one of them is the post-colonial experience and not wanting to be seen to be relying on Australia, and the classic example is the education system. We, in the past, we had Papua New Guinean students in large numbers coming into the Australian education system through the boarding school arrangements. All the kids that went to Charters Towers and other of the outback boarding schools and so on, for example, that doesn't happen anymore. And a lot of that was our fault as well. We decided, we're going to build our own education system and we don't need to come into the Australian system anymore. So I think on both sides, there's things happening that I suppose mean the relationship is not as intimate as it used to be. But I, for the interests of both sides, I think we should not allow that to happen. You know, I honestly think, as I've said, I think it's mutually beneficial to have a more open relationship. It doesn't serve anyone's interest to have some of these visa requirements and trade restrictions that we sort of say things in terms of the relationship, but we don't actually, there's not some genuine input behind it to reflect often what we're saying. And it's little things like having these complicated visa arrangements. It's little things like Papua New Guinea's constant inability to genuinely trade with Australia because of all sorts of regulations and requirements that no matter how much we say, ultimately trade from Australia to Papua New Guinea in terms of manufacturing trade or tuna exports, things like that just don't seem to really progress. So I mentioned some of the examples of what I think in terms of that engagement. And I sense a bit more sensitivity around this issue, particularly in the light of what is happening regionally in terms of some of the other players coming in. So I hope, and it's my intention as I speak to Scott Morrison and Julie Bishop, that it can provide an opportunity to relook at some of the ways that we are engaging. And as I said before, we can progress some of the... Because it's not necessarily a commercial thing all the time. It's not necessarily a money thing. It's an engagement thing, and it's that integration and contact that I think we can work more on. And I repeat that's where Australia has the competitive advantage. You know, we have a soft spot for each other. I think we've got to go back and revisit how we're actually displaying that affection. And I mentioned some examples of how I think that can happen. I know there's some very good initiatives already underway. For example, what the Lowy Institute does in terms of the Australia-Papua New Guinea network, that we had the opportunity to listen to some of that. I know Julie Bishop is always talking about the Colombo plan and the people-to-people engagements. I think we need some of the other politicians in the Australian system to also take on that sort of a view and approach. It's not just about building roads and building classrooms. You know, it's about having Australian teachers up there, having Australians in some of our institutions, particularly the universities, and having more Papua New Guineans down here. Like I said, it can be sport, it can be through education, We need to break down some of the barriers between the two countries, and Papua New Guinea will certainly benefit, and I think Australia will as well. And not the least of which will be, you know, young Australians learning about what Papua New Guinea is all about, the truth about Papua New Guinea. You know, it's, as I said, in the past there was a much more intimate relationship. People had that engagement. Young Australians these days, I don't think they know much about Papua New Guinea at all. They only understand the negative side of things, and we can break a lot of those things down. Australians can benefit from that rich experience that we can offer in some of our villages and towns, and of course we can do the same by coming here. So, Mike, that's my long-winded speech and response.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we definitely have a soft spot for PNG here at the Institute, and we're very honoured indeed to have you back, Charles, not for your first time to the Institute, but for your first time speaking from this podium in this role. Thank you very much for giving such a substantive speech, and I think all of us saw in the substance and comprehensiveness of your remarks, but also in the deftness of your response to the questions, why you're such a force in PNG politics now and in the future. And I'd like to add my personal thanks for being the first person in the 15-year history of the Lowy Institute to use the words penis gourds at the Institute. My board will no doubt ask me questions about that, but that's an issue for me. So, Charles, thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking the BPN.